What's happening, guys? Welcome to the show. Welcome to another Wednesday afternoon and yet another episode of Action Movie Anatomy. We're going to be covering one of the greatest films of all time today. This is Braveheart, the epic movie made by the epic man, Mel Gibson. We're going to break the whole thing down for you guys. We'll see you in just 1 second.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Action Movie Anatomy.
Boom! What's up, everybody? Welcome to the show! Oh, it's epic. That plays every day.
Yeah!
No, no,
put the sword down. Put the sword down.
That is a real sword, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Action Movie Anatomy. This is the real Braveheart sword sent from another country, Europe itself.
Did you guys it wasn't actually from Scotland?
Because
you gotta have both hands on it to really do the damage.
Yeah. Yeah, the music was so loud and epic that I felt picking up the sword in that moment.
You should have just yelled freedom.
Yeah. Marissa, can you send a new pair of pants?
Oh, God.
Welcome to the show, guys. This is Action Movie Anatomy. That's the Braveheart sword.
It's real.
Yeah. We are going to be covering Braveheart today, guys. Welcome to the show. I'm your host, Ben Bateman. I'm joined by two wonderful people today. I've got Andrew Guy, of course, the co-host, co-creator, and co-producer of the show.
Hello. I'm here.
Hello. I'm here.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's good.
So you're gonna get a lot of that today. Don't worry.
Oh great.
Yeah,
I'm excited.
Like almost the entire time we were watching the movie, we were just talking in Scottish.
I can still
accents,
quote that movie word for word.
Can you really?
I still can.
Wow.
Start now. We got 3 hours to kill.
The wonderful and beautiful woman on the end of the table is beautiful, wonderful host Keaton Marchie. Welcome to the show.
Hi guys. I'm so honored to be here, especially for a Mel Gibson film. I guess I should just say, this is the first time I ever saw Braveheart.
Which is astounding.
It's astounding.
And she was so excited to watch it, but I think I was more excited to watch Braveheart with someone that had never seen it before.
Yeah, right, totally.
When are you going to do that?
That's how I feel about Michael Clayton.
Yeah. we still need to do that soon. Michael Clayton is a great film.
I put those two on the same level, right?
I was just like, whoa, you just pulled that one out of there and we're talking Braveheart here?
Ben loves Michael Clayton.
It's a good movie. It's a good,
very
movie.
Good film.
I've never seen that either, so.
Yeah, it's great.
Okay,
it's great.
Well, Michael Clayton.
So yeah, guys, Braveheart, this is awesome. If you guys want to follow along in the conversation, you can find any one of us or the podcast. Of course, I'm Ben Bateman. You can find me at Ben Bateman Media on Twitter and Instagram. Andrew, where can the folks find you?
You can find me at Andrew Guy. And you can find our podcast at AMA Podcast.
And you guys can find me all over the interwebs at Keaton Markey.
But that's C-H-I, right?
C-H-I, like, it's Italian. Like Marchi, yeah. But Markey.
Like Markey.
Markey.
Yes.
Yeah, and Keaton is K-E-E-T-I-N. Not like our, you know, the wonderful Michael Keaton, but not like Batman.
Yeah.
Batman.
So why don't you do the Scots voice and you do the Batman voice?
Perfect.
I won't have a voice.
And you can do your check it on the ones and twos. Yeah.
I'll just periodically pick up the sword.
Yeah, I was going to say, he has a sword. He doesn't need to change his voice. I'm just very... Oh, that like seriously, this is so
real.
It's
very sharp.
Yeah. So we'll do a quick, just to show you guys what's going on here. This is actually not even a joke. It's the real Braveheart sword.
It is.
Let's see all the different cameras that can see this here.
It's not like the real one from the movie, but yeah, it's a real replica.
It has the blood of Englishmen on it.
It was actually made. It was made in Italy and shipped over here. My roommate, who you guys have heard of many times if you watch or listen to our show.
Handcrafted, folded steel.
He spends a lot of time ordering replicas of weapons from his favorite movies. So
Valyrian steel, actually.
Yeah. Along with, you know, the machete from
Rambo.
Patriot and also the Rambo knife.
Yes.
And this. He has all those things.
Jeff's a cool guy.
He's a cool guy.
Why is Jeff not been on this show with all of his weapons?
He would just, like, freeze up and just, like, pet the sword.
Just, like, cut himself while petting and just act like it's not happening.
So, anyway, guys, yeah, that's what we're doing today. We're doing Braveheart. It's awesome. It's won Best Picture 1995. It's, like, one of the all-time great movies. It's been 21 years, so it's definitely an interesting time to revisit the movie. It feels very different than it did. I watched this movie probably the first time. I would imagine somewhere in the early 2000s, like, 03 maybe, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking it was really, really good and, like, a part of history. But as a full-grown adult now, and Mel Gibson's whole star and perception has changed drastically since then, it's a different experience watching the movie.
Were you affected by it when you guys watched it? I didn't feel for a second. I think it's interesting because I have such a love for this film, and I've watched it so many times for so long that there was things that, like, Keaton were pointing out when we were watching it. She's like, oh my gosh, like, the blood in this third battle or second battle is so disproportionate to the first two.
Yeah, right.
And it's true, because in the first battle, it's just, like, buckets of blood everywhere.
Yeah.
And I don't know if it's because they were worried about an NC-17 rating or something, they had to tone it back, but there's so many things in this film. She was mentioning the makeup of the father and how it looks kind of poor now. But, like, I didn't mind the makeup. I don't mind the disproportionation of blood. And then I don't mind Mel Gibson's star and where it is now. I think it's because I have such a love of this film as a child that it can't be affected.
I'll have to say, like, The Patriot is my favorite movie of all time. Mel Gibson's, I think,
so
maybe.
Sweet.
That's so my favorite. Good. Like, anytime people ask, I'm like, oh, The Patriot's my favorite movie. But I love Mel Gibson. And I know he's been through a lot of ups and downs and, like, whatever. But I think Mel Gibson as an actor and as a director is awesome. As a human being, meh.
Yeah.
Don't really want to talk to him about that stuff. But this film, I feel like if I would have watched it, like, I think I did not watch this film for as long as I didn't watch it because I was scared of the blood, guts, and gore. And now, then I watched it as an adult, and I was like, this is such fake looking blood, and it was so 90s. Yeah.
It was. It's
but
very
it was so
90s.
Great and beautiful, and just, yeah, the battle scenes were, it's no Game of Thrones.
Definitely. I think it's, we've talked about this with a bunch of people, namely our boy TC, but I think the swing back is one of the more interesting things to watch on.
Who's TC?
Tom Cruise.
Oh, right.
You're on just like initials level with TC?
I was like, is this a person that we know?
I just made that up, actually. He didn't catch us. It's surprising.
I thought it was one of our friends.
Well, yeah,
he
I
is one of our
too.
Friends.
Like,
he is one of our friends.
I'm so sorry, Tom. I've embarrassed you and myself.
But the swing back on Tom Cruise is, obviously it's different. I mean, look, let's be real, guys. It's, Donald Trump was elected president last night, and
in lieu of these events, I have there's a prop that was passed in California that I took advantage of for
marijuana
the show.
Marijuana is legal.
Okay, that wasn't exactly what I wanted to be said. But the other thing is that, yes, Mr. Trump is president, and I think I'm going to tie that whole thing into my thesis statement.
Well, so what I was going to say is, I mean, look at that and think about all the things that guy said over the course of the last 6 months to a year, all the things that came out, all the horrible things that were racist, things that...
And he's president.
I mean, Mel Gibson, the biggest, like, he had a bunch of scandals and was out of movies for a few years. No one cares in terms of how they actually... I mean, everyone cares in the sense that it matters, but no one cares in the sense that they will regard Braveheart as a classic, because that's just the way people are. It's, what have you done for me lately?
Yeah,
that's how people's brains work. They don't... Things aren't separated for people like that. If they like something. If they like Trump, they're going to vote for Trump no matter what he said. If they
except
like
Bill Cosby.
Yeah.
True. Bill Cosby.
I guess there's a level you can go that's...
Bill Cosby.
There's a level you can go that's past it. But anyway, without dwelling on politics, I think it's an interesting example because of how hated Mel Gibson was in the mid-2000s. It was such a crazy, crazy turn.
I don't think he's come back yet fully either, and that's why I'm so excited for his new film that's coming out that he directed.
Hacksaw Ridge.
I cannot wait for this film. It's getting so much acclaim. And I just feel like Mel Gibson kind of very slowly been kind of, you know, throwing himself back in the spotlight, reminding us of, like, who he was before all of his personal and political stuff got involved and, his stardom and, you know.
Right. I think he needs to win us over as a director before he wins us over as an actor again.
Well, so, and we will revisit that later in the show. So let's continue down the path here, guys. We are going to start with the trailer for the film. Cue it up here. We've got Marissa up in the booth. How you doing, Marissa?
Marissa Serafini.
Great, guys. Thanks.
Do you love Braveheart?
This is such a good movie.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me that you love this movie. It seems like a Marissa movie.
Marissa loves good movies. That's one thing that's awesome about her.
It is a great movie, but here is the trailer.
Marissa, real quick, where can people find you? No?
You can follow me on Twitter at SerafiniTV.
There you go.
Sweet.
Pops and God willing.
God willing.
Makes Mullet look good.
That's a bit sudden, but all right.
Is that what you call a proposal?
The music's so sweet.
I see Mel at this always time of life, and my heart melts.
One of my favorite parts was almost a fist pump when Argo's like, they're playing outlawed tunes on their bagpipes to say goodbye. And I was like, outlawed tunes on bagpipes.
And then Cox just kept eating.
And then he just kept eating.
I want to stay here with you.
And I with you.
I love the way warriors eat in these movies is they like tear pieces of bread.
It's like medieval times.
His world. Edward Longshanks is the
world. Yeah, the narrator for this trailer is perfect.
Scotland. My land. And the woman.
Longshanks a great villain.
Oh, he's one of the best.
And children. So great.
Problem with Scotland. Is it full of Scots?
He was driven to war.
Go back to England.
Holy shit. Sorry, live chat. I didn't realize you guys were hopping. I'm like four pages behind.
I'll go find it.
And who? William Wallace. He rallies new volunteers in every Scottish town.
We've come to fight and to die for you.
Stephen!
Pick a flock of your finest assassins and set a meeting.
My lord, Wallace is renowned for his ability to smell an ambush. and you'll dispatch our future queen with the notion that she comes in peace.
Longshanks desires peace.
He declares it to me, I swear it.
You tell your king.
He declares it to me, I swear it.
Nor will any.
She was 4 years old when William Wallace. All this happened.
Where are Ben and Drew? I'm drunk. Let's do this.
Why do you help?
Because of the way you are looking at me now.
Ben, how tall are you? The audience really wants to know.
6 foot 6?
Yeah.
Well, you're not 6 foot 6. You wish.
Ben's 6'2" on a good day.
On a good day.
You're 6 foot 6.
This sword makes me 6 foot 6.
Oh, come on.
What?
The speech?
How can you put one of the
greatest lines in movie history in the goddamn trailer?
Yeah.
Oh, the music, the sword.
If we win, we'll have what none of us have ever had before. A country of our own.
And Scotland is still fighting for a country of their own.
Braveheart. I'll be honest, that's a very, very good 95 trailer.
It's a solid 95 trailer.
Very, very good 95 trailer.
You guys should do like movie trailer anatomy.
We would.
We've talked about it many times.
We really have.
Yeah. It's a solid 95 trailer. It's no Snake Eyes. It's no Congo.
It's no Matrix.
As a slave.
Yeah. That was a simultaneous water drink.
Ben and I like to drink at the same time. That's something that we do.
They're really cute together.
So let's get into our rules and see how this does on them.
So we cover action movies on the show, guys. Once again, this is on the Popcorn Talk Network, the online broadcast network dedicated to talking movies and all things movie related. And the movies that we do on this show adhere to four basic rules. So the unofficial rule is that the movies are made after 1981, which I think in 80 episodes or something, we've never broken the rule.
We've never broken that rule. That's not even a rule.
We've broken every other rule plenty of times.
And every time I tell anyone about this show, they're like, why is that a rule? I'm like, it's not.
Really?
It's just we just haven't done them. I think it'll alienate part of our audience. I think that's the problem.
Yeah, maybe. There's never been a movie that we've come across that was like
We're just showing how young we are.
Yeah. Rule number one, the hero always plays by their own rules. I mean, yeah, this is not really traditionally an action movie, but he's still cut from the cloth.
Are you kidding me?
Oh, William Wallace plays by his own rules.
He's like one of the best action heroes ever.
Oh, no, he is.
Okay. Whoa.
But this is not an action movie in the way that, like, Die Hard or, like, Lethal Weapon's an action movie. Those are, like, it was of a time. So what I'm saying is, but they still cast him. He still made the movie and starred in this movie as a hero. Mm-hmm. In the vein of like all the characters that those guys were playing at the time, he is the smartest guy in the room.
Absolutely,
he's a superhero in this movie.
He is,
right?
Yeah. He's 7 feet tall and shoots lightning bolts out of his arse.
Yeah, exactly. So he does play by his own rules. Rule number two: the hero and the villain are always the smartest people in the room. Longshanks is cunning as he is ruthless.
Except in that last scene when what's her name, the queen, goes and whispers in his ear,
and he's lost his power of speech.
He's done.
Yep. Yeah.
I wish that was true. I'm pretty sure that is 100%
not true.
Oh, it is so
100% not true.
But that is one of the greatest things in the whole movie.
Yeah, definitely.
Because it's the only fuck you get to the king. He wins.
Yeah.
He wins.
Totally.
He tortures the hero. He wins the battle. He keeps England. It doesn't get invaded. He wins.
Well, he unites Scotland in the end, and then Robert the Bruce.
Robert the Bruce.
Robert the Bruce. Actually, Robert the Bruce is the real guy who the name Braveheart was taken from.
Yeah.
So that's true. William Wallace was never called Braveheart.
Right.
The Bruce was Braveheart.
Yes, that's what I heard that as well. Rule number three, the movie is driven by a police, military, political, or mercenary figure. He's not military. He's a knight in
the
end.
He's a knight. Not even in the end. Just after the first battle.
Yeah. So I guess he is kind of... military, but
you know, this movie,
he's a political figure too. They use him so much politically,
but he doesn't participate in politics whatsoever.
He's a scrapper in the beginning.
He's a martyr.
Yeah, so he's not. Yeah, kind of.
I will not be a martyr.
This is a half rule, I'd say.
I'm gonna just quote this movie the whole show and not make any sense.
Rule number four: the movie contains a minimum of one explosion. There's a bunch of explosions, right? A bunch of fire and burning.
Explosions of emotion as well.
Yeah. I guess there's a lot of burning. There's no explosions.
I actually don't think
explosions of intestines. You just don't see it. You just see it on Mel's face.
Yeah. An explosion of awkwardness in the sex scene between him and his wife.
So awkward.
Yeah. She's like, I'm gonna present the back of me and you're gonna present the front of you and we're gonna stand.
Yeah.
It was like we were just like watching, we're like, this is definitely the most awkward
sex. This
is
how you have sex.
Ever seen.
Yeah.
It made me question everything about like historical accuracies when it comes to kissing and sex. And I was just like, have we changed as a human race? Like, what is going on?
Yeah.
Like, Mel, how much research did you put into this sex scene? either not enough or too much.
She was beautiful.
She was Mel, very beautiful.
Yoke, he's in great shape.
He
in this
looks
film.
Fantastic.
He's great. I wonder what his training regimen was like for this movie. I mean, Mel was in pretty damn good shape in his prime.
He was.
He still looks good, guys.
He's 40.
I mean, think he just walked around and was kind of angry and like flexed all the time, and maybe. That was just how he worked out.
Yeah, yeah. Great delts. All right, let's very keep moving on. let's get into the next section of the show, guys. This is called Thesis Statement. So this is that part of the show where we share something that is a very strong idea, a strong opinion we have, something we're going to kind of defend all throughout the movie, and it should almost be like rooted in hyperbole, the best this, the greatest this, the only this, the first mm-hmm. this, not something loose like this is my favorite this or something. That's kind of how we do it. We usually like to defend it throughout the show, kind of like a thought you would share at a party with someone if the movie came up. So
I think I want to go last.
You want to go last? I'll go first.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay, go ahead, Keats. I hope I did this Keats. Right. Okay, I have two, because one's kind of
You've
like
done
serious
it wrong.
And
it's
one's
already wrong.
I'll only share one.
You can do
okay,
both.
I said that William Wallace is the most badass action hero because he never has to use a gun, just his wits, will, bravery, and physical strength.
Okay, excellent.
I like that. I'm going to clean it up for you, though, because you actually said this while watching it. And she was basically saying that the most badass action heroes throughout history don't use guns.
Batman.
So wait, are you saying that William Wallace is the most badass action hero of all time? Is that what you're saying?
No, I say because when you guys sent me the notes, I was like, oh, I guess I have to be more specific to the movie.
Right.
But I agree with Andrew. When I was watching it, I was like, in general, the most badass action heroes are the ones that don't have to use guns because I think it's a cheap, easy way out.
It's a strong point.
I like that, and I'm going to hop on board with that with Maximus Decimus Meridius.
Yeah.
Anybody ever heard of him? all of the Lord of the Rings, Batman.
Yep.
All the superheroes. Batman. Like, it's awesome. Not all the superheroes.
Not all.
Yeah, but most of them. Yeah,
most of them have their own powers. They don't use weapons.
Yeah, true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a strong point. I'll give it to you.
And like here's my one other one. Okay. It's a little silly. Stephen the Irishman is the most underrated and forgotten action movie sidekick ever.
Oh, absolutely.
Stephen the Irishman.
Stephen the Irishman.
He's the one that talks to...
To
right?
God.
Yeah, talks to God.
All the time. He has just full-on conversation.
Stephen's my favorite character in the movie.
He's the best.
He's a good character.
He's awesome.
Yeah. You loved him as a kid, didn't you?
Oh, he was so awesome.
Yeah.
He was the coolest guy.
Because he saved him in the beginning in the
and
forest.
He's just crazy as fuck.
I like how I don't even have to argue these. You guys are both just like, yeah, no, I agree.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely.
Okay,
strong points.
I did it right.
All right. What's yours, boy?
Boy?
Yeah.
I'm
Boy
a man.
No, you're not. Don't pick up the sword.
Man.
Don't pick up the sword.
Don't get him angry.
I've demonstrated this several times already, but as we were reminded with The Patriot and what Braveheart taught us is that Mel Gibson has the greatest guttural war scream of all time. Ever. Yeah. He's like, he is so confident.
I hope you didn't cut to me when I did that because I'm going to terrify children.
I'm going to get off the mic here, but it's like he's saying nothing. It's not like... He's just like yelling.
I love when he yells "bastard" at the cat, at the dude on the horse.
Yeah,
after
right.
The very first, he's like, "Bastard!"
Yeah,
he just, like, charges at him. You're like, "Jesus!"
Because I also
you're horrified.
One of my favorite moments in Patriot is when he steps out from behind the tree and he's like,
"That is."
Can
your
you do it
moment.
One more time? Just one more time for me. I just want to like get that in my memory for forever.
But I think his guttural war screams are the greatest of all time, and I think Braveheart is really the movie that showed us that he's got at least one phenomenal guttural war scream in this movie. Am I right?
You were very right. Okay,
and
there's no arguing that.
Scottish one too.
So. Mine's like very meta. It's weird.
Oh,
yeah. Again, thank you, Prop 60, whatever. This movie's a perfect metaphor for what's going on in our society right now. By character. So we got Edward the Longshanks. That's
okay.
Mr. Trump.
Okay.
So he's in charge now. He's actually the king.
Yeah.
So this is even better now today. It holds more true
it's
because
better?
he's the king. No, it's not. Look, we're not going to get into politics
no,
on this.
Not.
Mr. Trump is now the president of the United States. There's nothing we can do about it. This is not for or against. This is just an observation.
Yeah.
So Edward the Longshanks is Trump. We got Robert the Bruce is Hillary.
Okay.
He did something corrupt. But at the end of the day, most of us wanted him to win,
right?
Or her to win.
Mm-hmm.
Let's
sure.
put it that way. Or most people.
Okay.
You got William Wallace. That's Bernie.
Yeah.
Oh,
right there. That's our burn dog. He's the guy that everyone wanted to win, but just didn't make it to the end.
Yeah.
And he died.
And people remember
Bernie's
his name.
Not dead.
Yeah.
And people remember his name, and everyone's like, "Well, shit.
He was a folk hero.
If we could have anyone do it. It would have been Bernie.
Yeah.
It would have been William. So that's really it. That's okay. My thesis is that this, like, driving here, I was just like, oh my god, this is perfect. We got Robert the Bruce, we got Edward Longshanks, we got Bernie,
we got Prop 61.
It's been working out really well for me.
Just real.
Yeah. So that's my thesis statement.
Is the movie
this
holds
movie
up.
Correlates directly to our political infrastructure right now.
21 years later.
Let's get into the next section of the show, guys.
Yeah! Yes.
We're gonna talk about something we like to do called Fist Pump Moment. If you guys have watched the show for a long time, if you are longtime fans or listeners, we do this thing. It's that moment in the movie you're watching and something happens and you kind of have a silent, like, gosh. You, like, look around. You're like, are you fucking seeing this right now? This is so awesome. I get to watch the rest of this movie. Could be anything. Could be the credits. Mm-hmm. Could be the music. Could be a headshot. Could be a look. Could be a line.
That is my favorite thing to describe to people.
Fist Pump Moment?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you describe it to me, you get really excited about it.
Really excited.
Really excited.
I was, like, in the kitchen cooking. I was like,
yes! Oh, but let me tell you about the Fist Pump Moment.
Punch Brutus?
No, Brutus.
That's my dog.
He Our watched dog. Braveheart with us.
Oh, he did.
It was the cutest
horses,
thing.
He would sit and just watch battles.
Just stare at the TV.
Huh. Yeah, he gets mesmerized.
It was hilarious.
I'm going to hop in with my fist pump since I went last on
thesis.
Yes, please, go ahead.
And my fist pump moment is... It's a Steven moment. Of course. Oh, God, do I want to save that for favorite line?
Nope, just you. Now you got to go. Just you got to commit, man. Commit.
All right. I'm going to say my fist pump moment is when the arrows start flying through the shields and one goes right next to Wallace's head.
Yeah.
And Steven's like, the good Lord tells me he can get me out of this mess, but he's pretty sure you're fucked. And he just, like, laughs and he gets all crazy at it. And then it's like right when they're about to go into battle. And I remember thinking as a kid, I was just like, if I could have any two dudes go to battle with me,
yeah,
it would be Steven and Brendan Gleeson.
Yeah.
These guys are so awesome. So seeing that again and being reminded and, like, having that moment again as an adult, like, almost 20 years later,
yeah,
where I was just like, fuck yes, yeah, Steven.
Those guys.
Steven, yeah. That was my moment.
I wonder, I it's interesting that neither one of those two guys dies in the movie.
Yeah.
You sort of throughout the movie, you're kind of like, you're both relevant characters, but it would make a lot of sense that one of you would die in a battle. I guess that's Brendan Gleeson's dad is that character.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. He's the
third captain.
Yeah. But, yeah, I thought that was interesting that at the end, they're just in there, you know?
You know, I'm kind
audience.
Of bummed because I did not, like, that's one thing I didn't research is whether those two characters are you know
real.
Based in fact at all.
Well,
but
so reading a lot about, you know, Gibson quotes and what he was saying about this movie is that a lot of it's historically inaccurate, that a lot of it's fictitious for the purpose of just, like, the dramatization of it, but mm-hmm. also that like they not even like things that happened or didn't happen, but like things like Wallace was like a kind of a just a bad dude, like he that like I read that he was like really gruff and always smelled of smoke from like burning villages down and like wasn't like this, like, you know, gentle, strong hero that, you know, that's what they did for Hollywood, which makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what Hollywood was back then. And I think now, you got to remember back in 95, that was when the first computer came in my home.
Yeah.
It was 1995. I didn't have the internet yet. I just played solitaire. That was all I did on it.
And the pinball game.
And the pinball game. I think that even came later. I don't even think I had that yet.
Oh, and the mine thing that you
Minesweeper,
blew up with Minesweeper.
Or Minecraft.
Yeah,
or Minesweeper.
Minesweeper.
Yeah, Minesweeper. Yeah. And I didn't even, like, understand it for 5 years. But anyway, the point behind this is that, like, back then, you didn't have to be as historically accurate.
Right.
You could just pull and pick parts from a story and make a great movie because people couldn't just be like, oh, William Wallace definitely didn't do that, and pull up your phone. And you're like, yeah, he didn't.
Yeah,
it's a movie.
I think that even today, when that stuff happens, when things stories are slightly historically inaccurate, it doesn't bother people anywhere near as much as, like, you'd think. It's generally speaking, like, talking points when the movie first comes out, and then if it's a good movie, like, take The Social Network, for example.
Right.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff was embellished or changed, and it no one cared. The movie's great. We remember the movie's being great. Like,
but I have major respect for when they can, because a lot of times you don't even need to change history. Look what just happened again in our country. You don't have to change anything. There, such crazy things happened, like, in the world and within wars and, you know, with building, you know, nations and stuff, that you don't need to change it.
Yeah,
and
right.
You just need to kind of do better research. So
pay more honor to the story.
Exactly. And so I have more respect. But if the film's a good film, it's a good film.
Definitely.
But I have more respect if they kind of try to stick to being historically accurate, especially with, like, the costumes. And that was one of the things that I read about that was not historically accurate, is the kilts. Kilts weren't popular really back then.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't a thing. But Mel Gibson has said that they had to do it.
She
I told him
that.
I knew somebody who had a kilt that I said you should text him. But Mel Gibson said it was important to have, like, the Scotsman in kilts and then the Englishman. The English, like, armor wasn't even accurate, but to be able to differentiate them in battles, when they had the big battle scenes, mm-hmm. like, they had to kind
yeah,
of just
they had to
give
like,
them their distinct looks.
Absolutely. Definitely. So, Drew, so that was your fist pump moment.
Steven.
Steven.
Yeah.
He's your fist
Steven.
Pump.
Steven is my fist pump in general.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree.
Even when he's crying at the end, you're just like, Steven.
Yeah. He's good.
Yeah.
Keaton, what do you got?
My fist pump, you know, this is a dude's film. There are two women in it, and I'm so happy that the second woman that gets introduced does get to have a little bit more control and helps, like, she's not the damsel in distress.
Right.
Like the first one, but, fist pump movie when, her real name was Miriam, but when she bites the face, like, the cheek off that one dude in that fight, and then also, I said it earlier, when Isabella of France whispers in Longshank's ear,
yeah,
like,
definitely.
Hey,
yeah.
By the way, got a little Scotsman in my belly.
Yeah.
That was great.
That's a great fist pump moment. Yeah, totally, because it is, like, the only fuck you.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, it's
awesome.
the only
moment.
Only one you get, and it's, like, girl power. She's like, this is all I could control.
Yeah.
And I did it.
Yeah, definitely.
So...
I'm going to go with when he comes back after her throat's been cut in the village and he takes everybody down. They kill everyone.
So awesome.
And then this is my favorite because this is such a Gibson thing. Like, Gibson, he's unique in his star in the sense that, like, one of the things that made him so loved was that his movies were really gory and he was super hardcore.
Yeah.
And there wasn't, like, it was, like, usually a little more rough around the edges. It wasn't as frilly. There's some stuff in this movie that is definitely, like, what we found with Gladiator, where it's a little bit of, like, there's some
Did
action movie
stuff.
Did you
find that as much
no.
in this
film?
Not
there,
at all, right?
There was some. There was a few scenes, but most of it not. But it's when he, they round up that captain and he walks him over to the pyre and he, like, puts him up to the thing, doesn't say a fucking word, and just slits his throat. That's it. He just takes
it's
care of business.
Awesome, right?
He just silently does it and just stares at him. And, like, that to me was just like, fuck yeah.
I love the,
yeah.
I love the captain, too.
That's
he's just
action
like,
hero.
Yeah. He, like, can't believe it's happening. And then he, like, puts him up to his throat. He's like, he's just, like, shocked. The whole, you could never do that to a magistrate.
No.
Never.
Yeah. Doesn't even, and he, like, Gibson just doesn't talk. He doesn't, like,
nothing.
Introduce,
just throws him down the hill.
He doesn't say, like, for my woman. He just, like, does it.
For Morden.
And that's one of the reasons I think, like, the Scottish were so successful, because they've been warring against English for so long, is because the English were so about kind of the rules of warfare.
Right.
And, the Scottish guys, like, they, Scotsmen, they are just, like, they're farmers, they're, you know, militia. Like, they didn't give a crap. And that's another reason, a thing that they kind of point out on The Patriot, too, of why America was that we were able to kind of win, because we were just kind of a bunch of, like, people who were just like, well, let's do whatever we can to win, that we don't have to follow any rules.
Right.
And, when you don't follow rules, it's bad ass.
Scrappers.
Scrappers, yeah.
Scrappers.
So the French and Indian War. So the audience here has got a couple of their fist pump moments. When they take down all the horses.
Oh, yeah.
The riding cavalry for the first time. You have no horse. That part was awesome.
Yeah, definitely.
The whole bunch, and then...
it's all mechanical horses. Did you know that?
We were wondering, because, like...
I'm the type of person, I watch
so
movies and
ruined.
I cry when the horses die.
It's all mechanical, like, horses. There was a claim by an Organization Against Animal Cruelty claiming that they were real horses, and there are these crazy, like, mechanical horses on, like, a 20-foot track. I'm sure the ones that were, like, riding are real horses, but any of the ones that are in the battle, they're, like, falling on the ground, or they're all fake. And Gibson apparently has some quote that he said in, like, an interview around the time the movie came out, where he was like, I'll give $5 to anybody who could point out the mechanical horses.
$5, Mel? Really?
Yeah.
That's it?
Well, that
he
was...
He didn't make good on the
So, speaking of that battle, the Battle of Stirling, that was actually originally called the Battle of Stirling Bridge. That's not how that battle happened. The reason the Scots were able to overtake the giant English forces was because the English had to cross this very narrow bridge.
Right.
So they could only send a couple guys over at once. So the Scotsmen just kind of picked him off as they kind of kept crossing the bridge,
right.
And the English were kind of just stupid to keep trying instead of just retreating.
Classic funnel strategy.
Yeah, but they wanted to shoot it in a wider meadow because it would have made for a better shot. So
it was a cool, it's a great scene.
Killing Demore in bed with the mace,
then
killing the dude that practiced Prima Nocta. Those are another two that people love.
Definitely.
That was a good one.
The killing him with the mace and then the body, like, falling through the ceiling and Gibson, like, sneaking around.
Yeah. That was a little 95.
Those are the 95, like, action hero moments where you're like, how is he getting in and out undetected over and over again,
right.
And also killing a guy and also, like, dripping his blood from the ceiling and then getting out.
And then throwing the body and sneaking away.
Yeah.
Search the building! He would be on the roof.
Yeah,
he would just search the building.
Yeah.
He's on the roof.
Yeah. Those are the moments where I was like, okay, this is, like, the...
Yeah, like going straight from like the fiery, bloody war nightmare into the horse in the room. Yeah, there's a few of those.
So let's talk a little bit about Gibson here. Yeah. Let's talk career profiles. This movie was made in 1995. It won the Oscar for Best Picture. He won Best Director. Mm-hmm. It was the precursor to 5 years later, Gladiator, kind of doing a lot of the same things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was nominated for actor as well.
This is also Dances with Wolves, which was just a few years earlier. This is an era where this happened a little more often.
Mm-hmm. Who won Best Actor that year if Mel Gibson didn't?
In 95?
Yeah.
Was it Forrest Gump?
No, it's 96. 94.
Or 4?
Yeah, 95.
Shakespeare in Love. No, it's 99.
That's 98. I think 95 is like...
Fact-checking.
Yeah, check it
Tom
out.
Tom Hanks for Forrest Gump.
No,
95.
Wow, look how smart I am.
But that's not true because it's the different year at the Oscars.
1995, the 70...
No, because Forrest Gump is 94, won Best Picture, and Braveheart won in 95. So,
this is really important about this film.
Yeah, well, I'm curious who won in 95. It might have been Jeffrey Rush for Shine, actually, now that I think about it.
I remember that coming out.
I think it was maybe Jeffrey Rush for Shine.
So Mel Gibson, in 92, made Forever Young, and then he went and did The Man Without a Face, which was also his directorial debut outside of the one that he directed. What was it called? Mel Gibson Goes Back to School, or it was something weird like that.
Uh-huh.
And then Maverick in 94, which kind of put him on the map as a badass.
Maverick?
Right?
Yeah. It's like the Western... He's
like a different type of...
Nicolas Cage.
Oh, yeah. Las Vegas,
of course.
Even
Las Vegas. One of my favorites.
Obviously. Sorry, that makes me so happy.
Since I was obsessed with that movie a few months ago.
Gibson is like definitely a little bit older and in a different class than a lot of the guys that we love from this era, because he came onto the scene originally with Mad Max in 79.
Exactly.
And then he got a lot of acclaim for Gallipoli, Peter Weir's movie in 81, which is a really strong movie. Gallipoli is great, but that's 14 years before this movie came out.
And then, it's like he had to reestablish himself as a different kind of badass every decade.
Yeah, totally. Like, the entire 80s for Mel Gibson is like Mad Max movies. Like, two and three are both in the 80s. The first Lethal Weapon's in the late 80s. Like, by 90, he makes Hamlet. So by 1990, he's already, like, successful 35-year-old, like... He's
great
been a
career,
big deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, his directorial debut is when he's 38 years old. You know, like, that's pretty young, all things considered. And he had already experienced so much success. What's even crazier is the fact that this movie came out in 95, but by 2002, he was totally off the map. Like,
shows what a few years can do and a few crazy decisions.
I mean, he was one of the most successful people. I think his net worth at this point is upwards of $450 million. Like, Mel Gibson...
How could it not be? With all these movies and franchises and films and direct... Like, the dude was unstoppable. That's why I think when it happened... I think the reason we hold on to it so hard is because we were so greatly affected by it. The same thing with the Cosby thing.
Yeah.
When you hold someone to such a high regard and standard, and then they turn around and show you their true character, and it's completely, like, mind-blowing and off-putting, it's hard to let go of that. Whereas, like, Tom Cruise was just like, Tom Cruise is fun and kind of crazy, and now Tom Cruise is kind of super crazy about his wife and Scientology.
Yeah.
That's not that bad.
Right. It's not the same
it goes
thing
away.
As hitting women
and
or,
being an anti-Semite.
Being anti-Semite.
After making
the
Passion
of Christ.
And getting arrested and DUIs.
You know, like, yeah, definitely. Definitely. 100%. I mean, we talked about that a couple weeks ago doing, I think it was Reacher, and talking about why Cruise has been able to rebound, and I guess why it's been so hard for Gibson. On the other hand, with Mel Gibson, talking about his career profile, he doesn't care in the same way. He's not trying to do what he did before. Like,
no.
You,
no.
And so I believe what happens with him is that he does all this stuff. There's like Ransom, Payback, What Women Want, all those movies in the late 90s.
People love What Women Want.
Yeah, people love that movie.
I just watched that a couple weeks ago.
Movie.
It's so great. Yeah.
The Patriot, of course, is the next attempt at sort of like a Braveheart-style movie. And then We Were Soldiers is like 02. But I believe after that, it's like he's in The Singing Detective. Then there's that movie Paparazzi that he's uncredited and he produced on.
Singing Detective?
He's not in another movie from between 2004 and 2010.
But also remember this, guys. Look at
Did
Mel
he just
Gibson's
direct
age.
It? Yeah. Yeah. That was it, right?
But, like, look at his age. Like, at a certain point, like... I feel like as somebody like Mel Gibson, he had already been in the spotlight for 3 decades.
Yeah, long
like,
time.
Like, at what point are you kind of like, meh, I don't really want to have to worry about all this so much and what I look like and how I'm perceived. I'm just going to start doing, like, the more kind of behind-the-scenes stuff and directing and
producing.
The artistic stuff and producing. And just because... And I think one of the reasons that his... All, like, the bad things that came out about him were so shocking was because he'd kind of been out of the spotlight a little bit around that time. So it was like... we weren't seeing any of the great Mel Gibson stuff. We were just seeing negative stuff.
Right. What time, or when did that actually happen?
Which? All the
2005?
It's like 2004.
Four?
It's like right around the same time as Paparazzi, the movie coming out. I remember that was the next release after all that stuff happened.
Right.
And it was bizarre, and he's not in it, but he produced it. And then it's 2004 is also when Passion of the Christ came out. So Passion of the Christ is the big, that's the big bridge in his career. 2 years later, he made Apocalypto. It's funny because both movies are regarded very well.
They're very good.
Yeah, and Passion of the Christ made an absurd amount of money.
Not only did it make an absurd amount of money, it had a massive cultural effect. I remember that was the only movie that people talked about for like several months.
Yeah.
And like the effect it had on them and their religion and people going back to church and people not going to church anymore. And just like,
yeah,
it was crazy.
Big deal. Definitely. Huge.
You know what? I want to have a conversation then. I want to talk about the top three things that Mel Gibson did in his career, director or actor.
Okay.
And I don't know if you have to rank them or not, but, and you don't have to do it by like performance. It can be however you think, whether it's cultural or just anything, effect on a genre. And I'm going to hop in and say that I think the greatest thing he ever did was Braveheart.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think Braveheart is the crowning achievement in his career. No matter how successful any of the other endeavors were, it does come down to Braveheart. That's the thing he'll always be remembered for.
I think Braveheart is the most positive, all-around great thing that he's ever done. I think one of the most polarizing, but still yet you can't like say it's not good film that he's worked on or been a part of is Passion of the Christ.
I would put it at number two.
It's very like some people love it, some people hate it, it's such a polarizing film, and so that I think is one of his like greatest feats, and that's one of the first times I feel like in modern kind of Hollywood that somebody's taken a religious story and really tried to show it for what it was with the effects and with like showing the gore and all of that stuff, and trying to be, I guess, as you know, accurate as possible.
And I think that was second on all of our lists as well, and especially for the reason that like that was the movie that everyone knew Mel Gibson directed. If you go, most people, did you know that Mel Gibson directed this before watching it?
Braveheart?
I had no idea. Remember?
Exactly.
Like, you told me, and you're like, oh, he directed this. Like, he directed this? What?
Most people, that's what you hear.
Yeah.
Like, I remember when I was in middle school and high school, I used to, like, my friends would always come to me for movie trivia.
Yeah.
I would just, like, say a movie trivia thing and blah, 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 and they would have to, like, try to figure it out, because we didn't have phones back then. And one of them was, like, Mel Gibson's greatest role of all time. Didn't win an Academy Award, but what did he win for? And like, they didn't know.
Yeah,
most
right.
people did not know that he won director. They're
definitely.
Like, well, what would he have won if he didn't win actor?
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's why Passion of the Christ falls at two. I really think this discussion was about number three, though.
Well, it's for me, it's between three movies. And each one of them has its appeal. So on the movie that I like the most of those three movies, it's The Patriot.
Yes, I was going to say, I'm going to pick The Patriot.
But in no way, shape, or form does it actually scratch the third spot, because that movie is irrelevant for most people. It's just it's a fun movie. The two others that matter are the second Mad Max movie, which is like the grandfather all post-apocalyptic films. I mean, that's the measuring stick the whole genre is pretty much based on. And then the other one would be Lethal Weapon, and that's because it's the buddy cop genre. And both of them, he's the guy.
He's the spearhead of both of those.
In both movies. And it's crazy. You look back and you watch both, they've both aged very poorly.
Very poorly.
Doesn't change the fact that genre is alive and well all the time. I mean, all the fucking time. Not to mention that a new Mad Max just came out.
Yeah.
And was like one of the most impactful movies we've seen in a long time. And I mean,
but does it say something about, like, what is a new, like, a reboot say about a film? And that Mel Gibson was not a part of it.
Sure.
Like, does that mean his Mad Max is not superior to the new one? Because the new one's pretty phenomenal. So that makes Lethal Weapon kind of the better film and, like, maybe number three spot? That's what I think, because nobody's touched Lethal Weapon.
Well, except there's a new show on TV that's pretty much an eye roll, but I think it's probably, it would come down to Lethal Weapon.
So you say Lethal Weapon, and you say The Patriot.
Well, I say The Patriot because that literally, that,
sheer love.
That is,
that's fine.
That's my favorite film. I cannot leave it.
Signs.
Oh, that's his third.
Oh, yes!
Signs is really good.
Signs. And I think it's because of who directed it, when he directed it, and when it came out.
Yeah.
That was one of those things where it was just like, you fell in love with Mel Gibson for a completely different reason.
Signs a really good movie.
It's a really good movie.
Yeah.
It's the only good movie that he made after The Sixth Sense.
Yeah.
In my opinion. I didn't really like Unbreakable that
much.
Unbreakable,
but it's not as good. Signs is better.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Interesting, guys. If you have your suggestion, you can send us your top three Mel movies at AMA Podcast.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, just at AMA Podcast. Tweet us. If you think that we're wrong on one, two, or three, I think one and two, it's pretty indisputable. But yeah, it definitely is interesting. We've done Lethal Weapon on the show. We have talked about doing one of the old Mad Max movies on the show and haven't because we feel they've aged very poorly.
I mean, to watch the original Die Hard, Rambo First Blood Part 2, and Lethal Weapon and kind of be let down by two out of three of them, if I'm being honest, even the original Die Hard was still a little bit of a letdown.
Yeah, for you.
Just for you. Not for me. Or, yes. 61. Yeah. but yeah, so like, it's a bummer when you go back and watch those and you hold them to such a high standard when movies that came out around the same time like T2 and Predator are awesome.
Yeah, they're fucking great. Yeah, totally.
Can I argue The Patriot really quick?
Oh, be my guest.
The rewatchability of The Patriot,
yeah,
it holds up today. Well, it does. Because... And because it holds up, I would say... And Mad Max, this has a shot. I think even, like, the battle scenes and the dialogue, even within that movie, are slightly better and easier to watch than Braveheart.
Well, The Patriot, I'll say this. I hadn't seen The Patriot ever until this last year when we did it on the show. Mm-hmm. I really liked The Patriot. I really enjoyed the movie. I enjoyed the movie, though, on the campy, this is a really fun popcorn movie level. Not, like, you're talking about, like, Braveheart and Passion of the Christ are, like, in a whole category of their own. But then when I think of the other movies we're talking about, even if they've aged poorly, like, the significance of those movies when you talk about something that matters is they're so much higher than The Patriot. The Patriot, to most people, is, like, Mel Gibson trying to remake a version of Braveheart a few years later and it being overly violent and like
you shut your mouth and you're talking to me.
I love Tavington. I love Tavington. I'm a huge fan.
Heath Ledger, come on.
I love the movie. Get out of here.
I know.
That was great. All
right. So on the other side, I went to Sophie Marceau because she's just awesome and I really think it's tough to argue that anyone else is really the second character. I guess you could do Longshanks.
Yeah.
But I think she has such a big part in this film. The three movies that she worked on beforehand are all French films. She'd done a few movies in America, none worth noting. But it's kind of interesting. Her career is very interesting in general because she definitely has done work in both continents, countries, whatever you want to call it. But she really never broke through to that level of being like a leading lady.
Well, they tried to make her the Bond girl.
I was just going to say, she was the Bond girl.
The World Is Not Enough, alongside Denise Richards is the other one.
And she was hot in it. She was hot and evil, but again, she doesn't have whatever that is.
Yeah, she didn't ever. You know? I mean, it is one of those hilarious examples of like someone who will be remembered for one role and then drop 90% and everything else they ever did in their career will be like there. Like not in terms of quality, just in terms of when you're in a movie like Braveheart, when you're like a memorable character in a movie that's as loved as that, it's kind of like you wouldn't really ever have to do anything else ever again because the movie will just be watched forever. People will always be that remember guy. That.
You'll be getting that residuals check from all the times it's played on TBS like every year.
Yeah, it's crazy. So for her, she is absolutely the other. She's the other lead. She's the other person that's memorable. But there's not much more to say other than World Is Not Enough, which was the big attempt. That was the big American movie they attempted.
That was the one to try to break her through
to
the next level.
What happened to Steven, level? Though? Because I would argue he is the other lead. he is amazing.
The fact that Brian Cox and Brendan Gleeson, if they're ever part of any film other than Troy, it's going to be a phenomenal film.
Well, Brian Cox, that's a strong argument for Fist Pump Moment, is Brian Cox showing up and almost immediately starts eating.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, just like almost immediately, like, and not just eating, but eating like a barbarian,
like a savage, just and he like has one eye.
Yeah,
of course,
he's great.
I'm your Uncle Argyle.
Yeah, I was so pleased to see him.
Me too. I forgot he. I yelled.
Yeah,
I that was almost like a fist pump moment right then.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's keep going, guys. Let's talk about who made this movie. A little bit of production development notes. Now, there's a lot of trivia, and we've shared a lot of it already. There's a ton to read about movies like this. Sometimes we find the newer movies that we do, there's not as much information out there. Movies like Braveheart, we could just rant pieces of trivia for the next like 20 or 30 minutes probably. So I think we'll skip through it because I think we'll run out of time if we do it. But talking about the guys that made the movie, Randall Wallace, the writer, believes that he's a descendant of William Wallace. No actual proof, but he claims this. And this is the script that put him on the map. He had not actually made a feature film.
Wouldn't you?
Absolutely. He didn't know who William Wallace was, but he went to Scotland and in his like visit to Scotland found out about the legend of William Wallace.
Oh, I'm his long lost nephew.
And that's decided, my uncle.
Decided to write the script and
I have his life rights because we're related. Yeah, that's hilarious. I don't need to pay for him.
And he ended up having a pretty successful career. This is another one of these things I was thinking about. This it's like I think the writing in this movie is good, right? Like I think it's solid.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, most people who watch movies have no concept of whether or not writing in a movie is good. To be perfectly honest with you, I think I do. I don't really know if I do.
Like, yeah, I mean, we find out more and more as we do this show, which is hilarious because this is just an action movie show, and it's amazing how many times an action movie has been up for, like, best screenplay or best movie, or best picture, excuse me. But, like, with Gladiator, when we did the research, that movie was a shit show.
Yeah.
The writing was changed daily. Russell Crowe thought the writer was a fucking moron.
There was, like, 30 pages of finished script.
Most people are fucking morons.
Absolutely. But, like, the point is that, like, I don't think we really know.
Yeah.
I think we find out years later about, like, oh, actually, there was a phantom rewriter on it. And he actually had a big hand in it, and no one knew about that.
Totally.
So
what I was going to say I think was so interesting is, like, so this guy ended up, the big credits for him were that he wrote this, The Man in the Iron Mask, which was the big...
I love that movie.
The big DiCaprio movie.
I actually do like that movie.
It's so good. Did you not watch Three Musketeers when you were a kid?
I did.
And it's so good. So then you could go watch Man in the Iron Mask, which was, like, also, like, it was a little bit later. Oh, so great.
Man in the Iron Mask. He ended up directing, I believe, Secretariat and We Were Soldiers. We Were Soldiers.
It's a horse movie.
Yeah. So, starring Diane Lane. And he also wrote Pearl Harbor. So, he kind of got a good run here for a few years where he got to do a lot of high profile kind of war movies. But it's just funny that, like, if you write Braveheart, like, you write that script, that's an original screenplay, and you get Mel attached to it, and Gibson decides that we're going to make the movie, and then the movie gets made, and it wins Best Picture. Like, you're set up for life now.
You can write anything.
The first script you ever wrote was Braveheart, and all of a sudden, like, you're just the guy that wrote Braveheart. For the rest of your life, you're the guy that wrote Braveheart. It doesn't matter if you make 5 bad movies, you're still the guy that wrote Braveheart.
Yeah,
you'll always get financing to get your script made because you wrote Braveheart.
But he hasn't been doing much.
Heaven is Real in 2014. Like, if a guy had just done Man in the Iron Mask, We Were Soldiers, and Secretariat by 2010, no.
Yeah.
You're done.
No one's
going to fund you again.
Every movie on here, like, Man in the Iron Mask is probably the second best movie by, like, review, and that's 3 years later.
And that's by a mile as well.
We Were Soldiers is not considered to be a good movie. Secretariat's a Disney movie that was a flop. I mean, Pearl Harbor is one of the most hated war movies ever made.
It is.
But I still love it, guys. I love Pearl Harbor.
I love it.
I don't care how bad it is, and even if they sing about it in Team America,
I
love Pearl Harbor.
Here. Absolutely. And I hate Pearl Harbor with a passion. Do we really need to talk about Mel Gibson some more with his direction?
No. We're gonna move on. So that's Randall Wallace, and then moving on to the producers. It's basically it's Gibson's one of the producers, Alan Ladd Jr. and Bruce Davery. Bruce Davery is a guy that has worked with Gibson forever. He's got like a dozen credits with Gibson. Pretty much that's all he's got. Alan Ladd is like a prolific, very, very famous producer who's worked on everything from Star Wars to...
you can't even say it. Like, I'm trying to sit here and pick out the biggest ones, and there's like... They're all giant, massive.
Yeah, it's weird because he was working as an executive for a long time. He then like the Ladd Company was his production company. So he jumped between being an executive and a producer for his whole career, but was involved with a lot of these movies. So if you actually look at his production credits on IMDb, it doesn't look as impressive.
Mm-hmm.
He's only credited with a few things. Like he's credited with like the Brady Bunch movie, but he's not credited as working on Star Wars. But I think he was the head of creative affairs at Fox when Star Wars was made. So it's like one of those things where he's just a guy. He's a legend who's been around. He's done a ton of huge things.
And then back here when he was chairman of MGMUA, he did A Fish Called Wanda, Moonstruck, Thelma and Louise.
Exactly.
Like, love Thelma and Louise.
He was one of these guys that was really good at his job running a studio, so he got put in to run studios. Great movies got made while he was there. He gets the credit even though he's not a producer on the movies every time. So it's a good position to be in.
Absolutely, and you should get credit for that. Let's move into critical and box office now. So this was released by Paramount. It only cost $72 million to make it, and it was released May 24th, 1995. It grossed $75 million domestic, making its money back, and then worldwide it added another $134 million for a total of $210 million in 1995, and it's opened third at the box office.
Yeah, crazy that this made $100 million less than Die Hard 3.
Yeah.
That's crazy, right?
And Casper!
And Casper opened ahead of it opening weekend. Do we have the worldwide, like, for the opening weekend there? There we go. Let's blow that up if we can. 95, it's so crazy when we go back and we do this.
Yeah.
These years, like 95, 98, 96, there's so many phenomenal movies come out. It's mind-blowing.
Totally. Classics.
I mean, I just watched Casper again on Halloween this year. And I love that movie. It's wonderful.
Ben, ooh, you're going to have to do the talking here because I cannot see anything.
We got, I see Apollo 13.
Toy Story. We got Apollo 13.
Pocahontas.
Oh, Ace Ventura 2.
Pocahontas. Also,
Pocahontas, yeah.
Also with Mel Gibson doing the voice of John Smith.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, Toy Story, Batman Forever, Apollo 13, Pocahontas, Ace Ventura When Nature Calls, GoldenEye, Jumanji, Casper 7. This is all domestic, by the way.
Oh,
Die Hard with the Vengeance at 10th.
So he's probably like, it's probably like 15th or 18th on there.
Well, it's an R-rated movie. Like, it's not going to be super high up there.
Yeah, Marissa, we're blind. Can you tell us where Braveheart comes in?
Braveheart comes in at 18.
Oh, 18. Dead on. Look at that.
Brains.
Yeah. that's domestic. So it is funny that despite this movie starring Mel Gibson, despite it being a huge Oscar contender, being well loved, it's crazy that Die Hard 3 could still make $100 million more worldwide than this. It's like,
I wish I could just see how much this made in just Scotland and how much it made in just England.
Yeah.
I bet you we could. I had a health teacher.
Yeah.
Health teacher back in seventh grade. His name was Mr. Jones. And he was Mr. Jones. He talked like this and he loved Strawberry Starburst. And
who doesn't?
He hated this movie. That was the first thing he said intro to every class.
Huh.
Like, you know when you do the syllabus?
Right.
It would be on there that Braveheart is a terrible movie, and then he would go into it and talk about how much he hated it and how historically inaccurate it was.
Was he English or was he Scottish?
He was English.
Oh, well, no one. Yeah, of course. Yeah. They make the English look like buffoons.
And then he's like, if I was getting tortured, you know, at the end of a movie, in front of all these people, I would not yell out freedom. Okay, yeah. This is absurd. Like, he would get, like, red in rage with it. So, Mr. Jones, just thought of you, buddy. It's
been
a long time.
That's pretty funny.
You
were scarred for life.
No, he wasn't. He's still by Braveheart.
Yeah. Just like everyone else, IMDb gives it an 8.4. It is in the top 250. I think it's, like, in the 50s.
Yeah.
Something like that. Rotten Tomatoes, 78%, 79%, and 85%. That makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, like, totally. Obviously the audience is going to be the highest, and it makes sense that critics would knock it down below the 80s.
Yeah, totally. This is of a genre of movie and of an era where it's, like, there's nothing about it that's, like, that impressive in the way that movies from the same time, there's, like, movies within a couple years on either side that are much more impressive. Like, Saving Private Ryan, to me, is, like, a much more, like, this is a movie that really makes me feel something. It's more impressive. It's better acted. It's a little less, like, a Mel Gibson, like, I'm gonna just be an action hero and be awesome movie.
I feel like this movie kind of started a new genre.
Yeah.
Slightly. A historical action kind of, like, basically a historical movie that they kind of made in an action movie type way. And that this is the first time you kind of really see that. And now, if you look back between that movie and until now, how many movies have tried to do that? And some been successful, some not been as successful, but
there's been a few of them. There's been, like, Braveheart did it for a couple
Gladiator.
Years, but it was, like, lighter. Gladiator did it, and it was really big. But then when 300 did it, that was when, like, all the other ones came out, like Alexander and Troy,
right.
You know, so that always happens. We've done that with disaster films, political films.
It's something that's popular. I mean, if you look at, but even just a couple years earlier, look at the movies that won Best Picture in 91, 2, and 3. It's Silence of the Lambs in 91, it's Unforgiven in 92, and it's Schindler's List in 93, Forrest Gump in 94. These are movies that are, it's not to say that they're better, it's just that they're not relying on a big sword-swinging action hero doing historically inaccurate things, saving a damsel in distress with no female characters. This is like a testosterone movie for a lot of guys.
Oh, this is such a dude movie.
Whereas, like, a couple years ago with Schindler's List, that's a real historical biopic.
Yeah.
You know,
it's
like,
an unbelievable movie that's done incredibly artistically. Like, that's what I mean when I say this movie, there's a reason that 78 and 79% could exist, whereas, like, Schindler's List, I would bet you is over 90 in every category. I'd be shocked
easy.
If it's not.
Yeah, there's no way.
Yeah.
So before we get to favorite line, then, do you think that Riggs, or do you think that Wallace, is the career-defining role for Mel Gibson?
Wallace.
You think Wallace?
Mm-hmm.
You think that's the one?
Mm-hmm.
Career-defining role conversation, is it Riggs or is it Wallace? I'm just trying to think if there's a chance that it's Max Roktansky.
I mean, that could be two. Oh, so we can do all three: Riggs, Wallace, and Roktansky.
I don't, but I think it does come down to Wallace or Riggs. And honestly, well, I think it's Riggs. I'm sorry. I think it's Wallace.
You do?
I think it's Wallace.
I think it's Riggs.
Really?
I really do. And I like this movie more than any Die Hard film by a mile.
You mean?
Lethal Weapon. I didn't even really like the first Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
After rewatching it, but I think, when you talk about Mel Gibson, when you think about Mel Gibson, for some reason, the first thing that pops in my head is Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
I don't know why, even though Braveheart and William Wallace are two of my favorite things ever, it's like, that's not who Mel Gibson is, though.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
I don't know. Lethal Weapon is who Mel Gibson is. He's kind of crazy, he's wily, he's got his accent, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. For me, and then also, I mean, that's where Rock Tansy comes in.
Yeah.
That's really the career-defining role, because he wouldn't have been able to do any of this without that.
Yeah, but it is that whole idea of, like, what do people regard him as in their mind? And for me, it is William Wallace. And it's close, because I can see the argument for Riggs. I can see where you would go with that, but I think it really, at the end of the day, it is Wallace.
I would argue this. I would argue that in each decade of his career, there he had a defining role.
Okay.
But I feel like Mel Gibson's Mel Gibson.
Like that.
That's who he is. Like, when I think of Mel Gibson, I just think of action star. Just think of Mel Gibson. And I don't think there's one movie that does define who he is. Because
right.
It just depends on at what point of time you're referring to. Like, if he didn't direct and act in this movie and it didn't get the acclaim that it did, he would have never been able to do anything after that.
Well, right, sure. But hindsight is 2020. If you give sort of credit in terms of, that's like the conversation we were having about which is the greatest thing he ever did. And that's where you can make the argument much more of, like, that's the whole reason I can argue for Road Warrior, is because I think it's like the Godfather movie of its genre. In this case, though, I'm talking about what is the role today in today's culture that Mel Gibson is synonymous with, in the way that for instance, Mark Hamill is Luke Skywalker. There's no chance it's anything other than Luke Skywalker.
Right. But that's all he's really done.
No. Right. Well, I mean, he has
voiceover acting, which
right,
is
but,
phenomenal.
But, like, the Joker is... That's been around for decades.
Yeah.
You know, same as Luke Skywalker.
So we've had the conversation, and I guess it's always that question of, like, how close is somebody to having that one role, or is there actually two? And in this case, there are two. At least two. I would just go Wallace, personally. That's my opinion.
Yeah, and the chat's split as well.
Yeah.
So, all right. Just wanted to talk about that real quick.
Cool.
Get on to our next thing.
Let's move on to favorite line here, guys. Now, I think this is kind of like the speech in Independence Day. It's
right. We got to null it.
Well, I'm going with that, because I watched the movie, and it's 3 hours long, and I wrote things down, and at the end of it, I was just like, every one of these is me trying to be clever, and there's an obvious answer, and it's like, it would be my fist pump moment and my favorite line if I didn't want to come up with one of each.
Exactly.
It's the best part of the whole fucking movie.
It's amazing.
It's awesome.
Can you just say it in a Scottish accent?
No, I can't, but Andrew can.
They may take our lives, but they'll never take... Our freedom!
Yeah,
because he loses it at the end there a little
Cue
bit.
Cue scream. Cue Mel Gibson awkward scream.
Steven's face. Keaton, what's your favorite line?
I wanted it to be that line, but I just was like, no, that's too easy. What did I write down? Where did we go? Okay. When he says, there's a difference between us. You think the people of this country exist to provide you with position. I think your position exists to provide those people with freedom. And I go make sure that they have it. I don't know. I felt that was a good line. I'm in the state of our country right now. I was kind of like, yeah, William.
Yeah. Well, and also, Robert the Bruce as a character is, like, definitely portrayed in a way that I think angered a lot of people, because he's regarded with Wallace as like an equal hero in the country's history, but because of the way they decided to make this movie, he seems like kind of a coward a little bit, kind of a turncoat.
Yeah, for sure. And then when you see him fight at the end and he has like that stupid look, you're just like, fuck this guy.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I think my favorite line, I mean, that's a great one. Freedom. Every time I hear him scream out freedom at the end, I get chills. So that'd probably have to be my next one. If I was like looking for my favorite line, I think it was early on when he's talking to his dad. He's like, I can fight.
Yeah.
He's like, I know you can, son.
Yeah.
It's like, but it's not the fight that can do it. What did he say? He's like, it's the wits that make us men.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
And
it's not like, the fighting that makes us men, it's our wits.
Yeah, exactly. And you're just like, fuck yeah, dad.
Yeah.
You're awesome. You're going to go die now, but that's awesome.
That's a fist pump moment, too.
Yeah. Touching moment between father and son.
Touching moment between father and son. Always good for these films. Shall we move on?
Do
we have any favorite lines in the chat here?
All of Steven's lines, I will say, could have all been my favorite lines, and I like started making a list of them, and then you've said a majority of them. So
we got freedom, and then we've got, of course, and he said, do you remember me?
Yeah.
Yeah, that those are the two that we got in here.
The
so
guy
far.
With the scar on his face who gets bit parts in all war movies?
Yeah, of course. He's great in Gladiator. Yeah. Cicero.
Yeah. All right, moving on. Let's get into AMA question of the day. We've got one from Ryan Martinson 01 at Ryan Martinson 01 asks, do you think Mel Gibson should be counted with the master directors in recent years with his short but great resume? You know, it's a really, really, really hard question to address, because if you look at each of the movies that have been great, Braveheart's one you kind of have to throw it out, because it's a great movie, and but he's also in it, and it's also in a time when his star was at an all-time high, and so many of the ways that movie is remembered has so much more to do with him as an action star than it has to do with him doing a great job directing it. So
even though he won the Academy Award for that one.
100%.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think after Hacksaw Ridge comes out through this award, I think we might be holding him up there, but right now, today, in this moment, he has a great resume, but I don't think he's there yet. Yeah. But I think he's going to get there.
He's directed four films, right?
Mm-hmm.
Man Without a Face,
Apocalypto,
Passion of the Christ, and Braveheart.
And Hacksaw now.
And the reason we're doing this movie, obviously, is because Hacksaw Ridge is coming out, but I would put it right on the edge for me, Apocalypto is a very underrated movie. Apocalypto is really good. That movie's well done. And then, obviously, Passion of the Christ is a polarizing movie. Mm-hmm. Well, I think well done, but also it's a movie that's difficult to properly rate, I think. Properly understand what you're watching or why it's good or bad. It elicits a lot of emotion for people, which I guess makes it a great film in that sense, just because it's important to people. Anytime a movie is important for one reason or another, it's relevant, you know? Not every movie done by a director that's bad but made an impact should be stricken from the record. It's still a part of the resume. It still makes them relevant for one reason or another. So I guess he is on the edge, and maybe you're right, Keaton. Maybe Hacksaw Ridge, you know, catapults him into that category.
I think it will.
For now, though, I think three movies in 12 years. He's no Terrence Malick, so it's not like you can say you can be three movies in 12 years.
I don't think he's even in the conversation, honestly.
Really?
I really don't. And I respect Mel Gibson's directing, and I respect his acting, but you got to think about the movies that he makes. And the thing about great directors is they make movies that are palatable to all audiences or to most audiences.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Whereas you look at most argument. Mel Gibson's films, in 1995, this movie was fucking gnarly.
Yeah.
It really was. It was a lot to take in. It was a lot of blood, a lot of limb lashing, torture. It was very hard to watch. All of his films are hard to watch.
Yeah.
Apocalypto was very hard to watch. Mm-hmm. So was Passion of the Christ. I don't know about Hacksaw Ridge, but if you talk about great directors, if you want to talk about the Spielbergs and the Camerons and the Nolans of the world, or even the Maliks, you know, guys like that, Paul Thomas Anderson and Aronofsky's movies are more palatable to me than Apocalypto and Passion of the Christ.
They make them more accessible. I completely agree with you. He just won the argument.
Yeah.
He did, if you have to be able to make your films accessible to a broader audience.
What's up, guys? I'm here every Wednesday at 12:30 Pacific Standard Time.
His head's going to explode now. Sorry, Ben. You have the big sword, though.
Yeah. So I think that's a strong point to be made. Maybe he gets there someday, but I wanted to speak on that really quickly about his movies not being palatable, because we were talking about his career arc and looking at where he is now, and I said this earlier about that he doesn't really care in the same way that other guys want to get back. They want their star to sort of be back there. He's not making the watered down kind of movies that he used to make. Like, you know, you for every Bloodfather that he makes, which looks as like bizarre and gnarly, he makes The Beaver or something like that, you know? Or he decides to direct Hacksaw Ridge, and it's like, those are the things that he's doing now. I mean, The Beaver I haven't seen, but that movie either. Sounds bizarre. It's like a struggling executive that decides to speak only through a beaver hand puppet.
I really want to watch
it. Me too.
Yeah.
But he's just, Gibson's like, I'm just going to do that movie. That sounds like an interesting movie for me to make. And, you know, there's this, like, Gibson's perception of him, the perception of Gibson now is kind of like at that halfway joke, like Chuck Norris, Nicolas Cage level, where it's like he's got this kind of aura around his persona that's like this gruff, ridiculous, outrageous, super tan, big smile,
kind of crazy.
Yeah, that thing a couple years ago, was it at the Oscars with Seth MacFarlane, where they had that moment on stage that was super awkward?
I don't remember it really, but
what that was for.
Yeah, something, Gibson came out to present something, and he got like, MacFarlane kind of made fun of him. It was just very strange and awkward, and it was like, this guy's like still a big producer. He's alive, he's out there, he's doing stuff.
He's still Mel Gibson.
Yeah, I think he's a much more relevant producer and director now than he is an actor. And I think he regards himself that way, honestly. I think he's willing to be in movies, but I just don't think that's the focus for him.
I think he understands. I mean, it's just like, it's the same thing. It's the weird thing with like Roman Polanski still being able to make movies and people still watching them, even though he's not allowed in our country.
Yeah.
It's like, I hate Mel Gibson. I don't want to see his face, but I love Hacksaw Ridge.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Totally.
It's one of those things.
It's the artistic separation. I mean,
Woody Allen? Come on, guys.
Woody Allen. Exactly. Morgan Freeman, even, like, for a guy that married his own granddaughter.
Yeah.
No one cares. Everyone loves Morgan Freeman.
Totally. Look,
he's,
I mean,
God.
I'm honestly, like, I'm Jewish 100%, and my dad has told me straight up that he won't watch a Mel Gibson movie ever again. He just won't. He just, like, through and through. And my dad's not that kind of guy. He's not rigid. He's like a very, very laid back dude. but he's just like, I have just no interest. I can't watch those movies anymore. That exists for some people. That's part of his audience is gone now. Like,
I'll say this. A friend of mine who worked with Mel on the Expendables film.
Yeah.
I interviewed him here at AfterBuzz and asked him about each of, like, the other Expendables. And he was saying, like, you know, Mel Gibson, the reason that I feel like Mel is so successful and still, even though he's done all these things, is still able to work and, you know, have people, you know, rally behind him is because he's a very charismatic guy.
Yeah.
Like, and, like, he told me the story of when his mom, he introduced his mom to Mel Gibson and just how, like, how cool the stories that Mel would say on set and how he's so nice to everybody and all that stuff. And it's just like, whoa, what? Mel Gibson? Like, that's your perception of him? And he's like, yeah. He's such a cool dude.
I know.
And I'm just like, whoa, like, that's crazy because obviously the media does not settle on those things. Yeah, they're not kind of him.
That doesn't
get
viewers,
and he doesn't jump through fucking hoops for the media. That's
the
other thing.
No, he doesn't, and I think that's why the media picks on him. Well, I don't want to say he did some crappy things. I'm not trying to defend Mel Gibson.
There's a reason
why
they pick that specific highlight reel for Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
Let's move on to. Do we want to do Cage versus Cruz? You want to say any of those lines?
I'll pass on.
You're
this
gonna
one.
Pass. Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right. We'll move on to the three categories.
Yeah, and I think this is an easy one. It's there's three action movie categories: totally legitimate, totally ridiculous, ridiculously legitimate. The first category, totally ridiculous, is like the totally ridiculous movies are like Con Air and Face Off. They're very silly. They fall apart
Demo
in the movies.
Man.
Yeah, they're hilarious and entertaining, but they are absurd. Totally legitimate are movies like The Fugitive, movies really like Terminator 2 that are really grounded, even if they are fantastical, well acted, dramatic, strong, don't really make you laugh unintentionally ever. And then the middle category, which is ridiculously legitimate. Those are movies like The Rock, like Point Break, like Speed, where they're awesome, they're compelling, they're well put together, and the movies are driven well, but there's definitely that unintentional laughter that happens throughout the movie here and there. And for me, this is an easy one. I mean, it definitely has a couple of those moments, but not anywhere near enough for it not to be totally legit. It's a legit movie.
Yeah.
It won Best Picture. Totally legit.
Yeah. I have to agree as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm going to hop in real quick before we do our last segment and just mention this real quick, because a fan just said something very nice, and they said that, just wanted to say, you guys, you got me through a difficult week with your past shows.
Oh.
And hearing something like that for Ben and I, and Keaton, I'm sure, even though she's not on the show weekly, not only is it sweet, but it also is it's very... It's gratifying to know that we are doing something that is helping people get through hard times in their life. Like, that's what movies are for us.
Yeah.
We watch movies because we love them, and it's an escape from reality. And we've had comments like this before, people in hospitals listening to our thing, or people in the traffic that they hate listening to our show. And so, guys, thank you so much for saying that. We love you.
And Ranger, that was Rangers Fan 1996, so. Yep.
Thanks, man.
Hey, man. Yeah.
I think you're a dude.
He's a dude. He said that he loved us earlier, no homo.
Yeah.
Okay. Cool. So what's the last thing we gotta do, Ben?
We've got this thing called The Pitch.
See, I don't know about these things, and I can't have fun with them.
You missed the cue, Keaton.
Sorry!
It was on the screen. Marissa rolled it.
She
it was
did.
Like,
she did?
Say the pitch.
No, oh, dang it.
It wasn't.
It was not there.
Okay.
So we have one that we're picking for you, because next week, we've been talking about this for a while, but a little movie from 2007 called Shooter, directed by a guy named Antoine Fuqua.
Shooter.
It's
That's a fun name to say.
Fuqua?
Yeah.
Fuqua.
The
Ben
TV
loves
show.
Fuqua.
Fuqua.
The TV show Shooter is coming out next week, and we are going to do the film Shooter that it is based on the next day. Guys, for those of you that have watched or listened to this whole time, I've complained more about Antoine Fuqua than any director ever. Him and Brian De Palma, but we don't do De Palma movies, so you hear me actually complain about Fuqua. I'm just going to list a couple movies we've actually done now.
Yep.
We've done London Has Fallen, directed by Fuqua.
Yep.
Training Day, directed by Fuqua. Magnificent Seven, directed by Fuqua. Like, we're just going to end up covering most of this guy's...
I celebrate the guy's entire catalog.
He's going to end up surpassing Tony Scott as the director we've done the most of his movies.
Yeah.
He will. Fuqua. We should just see if we can get him on the fucking show.
We should. I mean, he's got nothing better to do other than make another bad movie.
Other than just make Magnificent Seven and tons
of
money.
But you guys, they keep giving him money to make movies. They might be bad movies, but people are paying to see him.
Stop calling him a great director and just call him a good action movie director. I'm all in.
I'm all in. We're going to do Equalizer next year, another Fuqua movie.
Yep.
I mean, no question here, guys. So, guys, thanks for tuning in to watch the show today. This was a lot of fun. We'd wanted to do this movie for a long time, and as you can see, we're starting to kind of loosen up with the qualifications. It doesn't need to just be a specifically action movie. We're willing to do epics, but I still think we're staying away from superheroes.
Have you guys done Lord of the Rings?
We did a special episode, because it's not our category, but we did a special episode that was all three movies.
It was probably one of my favorite episodes of all time.
We've ever done.
It's the best.
This is a fucking great episode.
And then we want to thank Miss Keaton Markey, of course, for coming on the show.
Thank you guys for having me. It's been a pleasure. And thank you for finally letting me watch Braveheart.
Of course. Yeah.
I love it. Now one of my favorite movies.
No
top
problem.
10, definitely.
No problem.
Good. I like hearing that.
Where can the folks find you?
Oh, you guys, again, can find me all over the interwebs at Keaton Markey.
And you can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Andrew Guy.
And you guys can find me Twitter and Instagram at Ben Bateman Media. And, of course, if you want to keep up with us, at AMA Podcast on Twitter. Share your thoughts. Follow along. We'll see you next week for Shooter. Thanks, Marissa.
Bye.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.